Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Matthew Dornan. This episode features a recording from a recent event at the Centre on Value for Money in Aid. Dr. Kathy Shutt from the Institute of Development Studies and Russell McKay from GRM's Effective Development Group discussed UK approaches to value for money in aid and practical considerations around value for money metrics. Stephen Howes was the chair.
Welcome to our forum on value for money. It shows what a topical subject it is that such a apparently dry topic could draw such a large crowd. My name is Stephen Howes. I'm the director of the Development Policy Centre. We're hosting today's event, I'd like to also acknowledge Patrick Kilby in the outset from the Department of Anthropology, who has also been instrumental in making it happen. Before we begin, let me acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. Today we have two speakers on the subject of value for money in aid, and they're coming at the subject from different perspectives, and we thought that because it is such a topical issue, in some ways a very old issue of aid effectiveness, how do we measure it, but in some ways a new issue with new language and being sort of presented, put forward with new urgency, and also a very big issue. So we thought it'd be good to bring speakers together with different perspectives. And so we have two speakers. Our first speaker is Kathy Shutt. Kathy's from the Institute of Development Studies, the University of Sussex. And if you follow this kind of debate, you'll have come across Big Push Forward, which is a forum that reflects on these issues of value for money. So as well as being an academic, she's got a lot of experience as well as a practitioner in international aid, and has a lot of practical experience in helping NGOs and official organisations, grapple with this issue of value for money. And being at IDS, she's very familiar with the DFID approach, and DFID, I guess, is a leader in this area, and whatever happens at DFID, sooner or later we're going to see it here in Australia. So I think that'll be very interesting to hear her perspective from the UK. So then our second speaker is Russell McKay, and Russell's actually on the phone. So can you hear me, Russell?
I can indeed.
Okay. So we're practicing a bit of value for money here. although actually he was meant to be here, but due to bad weather, his flight from Brisbane was diverted to Sydney, and then the flight from Sydney got delayed. And so thanks very much to Marco and Han, who was here until a minute ago, who've set up this phone. So he's got slides, and between the slides and the phone, I'm sure Russell will be able to make a full contribution. So Russell is with GRM. So GRM is one of the big consulting groups, and they have set up something called the Effective Development Group, which works in this area and which makes an intellectual contribution to issues around aid effectiveness. And it's great to see consulting companies step forward and contribute to the debate. I think we can learn a lot from their on-the-ground perspective. So Russell's trained as an agricultural economist and has had long experience also in implementing aid projects, but is currently focusing on the area of M&E and providing M&E input into projects that GRM's involved in. And so he's also going to be speaking from his own experience. Okay, so that's enough from me. Two speakers I've asked to speak to 20 minutes, but maybe they'll go for a little bit longer if needed. And after that, we'll open it up for questions. We've got an hour and a half in all, so there should be plenty of time for questions. So over to you, Kathy.
Okay, thank you.
So maybe we can welcome Kathy. A round of applause.
Okay, nice to be here. As you can see from the title of my presentation, I'm not going to be talking about how to do value for money. My interest is more at looking at how official aid bureaucrats, NGO practitioners, etc., respond to a sudden new government directive. So I'm really looking at the UK experience of what happened since it became a major agenda for the government. So I'm going to talk a bit about my positionality and methodology, A bit about the links between value for money and the politics of evidence, which is very much where my position is in looking at this issue. Some of the confusion, competition and collaborative efforts that have really shaped what's actually happening and how value for money is playing out today. Some of the tools that are being used, some of the effects that are emerging, and looking at what are the particular factors that influence very contingent effects in very different places. And then some of the tactics that people that are very interested in, how can we use the value for money agenda to enhance locally led transformative development rather than a very sort of donor-controlled agenda, and then draw some conclusions. So as Stephen alluded to, I have a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde personality when it comes to value for money, because I'm interested as a critical academic in critiquing new public management approaches, and I'm very interested in practitioners' responses to political directives. But as a practitioner, I've got a management accounting background, I'm very passionately interested in how can value for money help us use aid and allocate aid better, particularly how to integrate financial considerations in monitoring, evaluation, learning and planning, etc. And that comes together in the Big Push Board, which Stephen alluded to, which is a group of practitioners who are a bit worried about the way the current sort of aid results and evidence-based paradigm is presented as a very sort of technical, linear approach to development, and sort of saying, how can we ensure that we make sure the good, the potential of that can be reaped, but that it doesn't mitigate any risk to a more locally led transformative agenda. And sort of my interest began, I suppose, in 2010. Value for money isn't new, it's been around for a very long time, but in the UK it's certainly got a lot more interest when the current right-wing coalition got elected to power in 2010. If you look through UK policy, government policy, in 2006 under New Labour, the National Audit Office started talking about value for money, but it was really in 2010 that it became a big concern. As you can see, the Minister of State went around telling everybody that we were going to tell taxpayers that we were going to use aid effectively and every penny would be spent through a greater transparency, independent evaluation and focus on results. So you notice it's quite a management, it's not so much about measuring, it's very much about how we will manage money better and how we'll show you we're managing it to get good results. Just talking a bit about the value for money and the politics of evidence. If you look in the critical accounting literature, there's quite a lot of discussion about how it's evoked. Value for money is evoked in public discourse during times of austerity, so one would expect it in the UK, a rising aid budget, less money at home. And it's often sort of talked about as this very sort
just
of technical.
Hello?
Sorry, Stephen, I got cut off.
Okay, we're just gonna put you on mute. So, but yes, call again if you get cut off.
Yeah, that it's sort of motherhood and apple pie, that we can work out how much things cost. Once we know that, we can just scale up and do it all better. And that this produces some quite distinct drivers. When I first engaged, we didn't really understand the different drivers and how they play out. And I think now it's becoming evident in British aid policy that one is around management and what we're calling results and smally evidence, which is political accountability to taxpayers, saying, are donors managing well? Are they getting good results for their investment? And a measurement approach, which policymakers are more interested in, which is really asking the question, is aid investing in the most cost-effective approaches? And those in WFID come from quite distinct areas of the organisation and drive different questions, different tools, different pressures. So you get a whole set of value for money tools that bring opportunities and risks that have been well documented. I won't go into them. People were very concerned, you know, does it mean we're just going to invest in things that can be measured, short-term change, etc. And in the Big Push Forward, we were encouraging people to really think about some of the assumptions underpinning the evidence and results-based paradigm relating to value for money, because it assumes that once we know how much stuff costs, we'll be able to replicate and get the best value for money. We were really asking, you know, how does change happen? Is it as linear as we suggest? What can we know about it? Are we very good at evaluation? Whose values do we use to assess it? What's our own contribution to that change? We tend to overestimate our value. Can we replicate what's good value for money in one place and another place? And is it really true, even if we know how much things cost, do the politics and agencies let us use that information to inform what we do, or is it used just to justify afterwards? So those are some of the questions. Anyway, while all the academics were pondering about that, the practitioners were getting in, what the hell do we do about it? So people, the M&E officers, were, this is, don't worry about the detail of this, I'm just trying to invoke the confusion that faced them. They were getting sort of signals from DFID of it's all about this very simple linear framework that you can just adapt to your projects and measure the cost efficiency, the cost of the economy, and the cost effectiveness. The independent age review audit body that we were all being a bit concerned about very usefully came in and said we need to talk about equity too. So for those interested in transformational development, that was very important. But it was still a bit blurred. And the one, the approach that I like is something that Bond, the NGO network, came in with, which was really looking at a more holistic approach to value for money, saying, you know, it's not just about measuring, it's about managing, understanding your costs, it's about being able to evaluate well, demonstrate that you're having outcomes, and then where appropriate, you can start making comparison and value for judgments with other actors, and then hopefully that would improve delivery of value for money. But as I say, when I started going to meetings in September 2010, people were really asking, you know, what is this all about? Is it just about management? Is it about measurement? Are we talking about efficiency or effectiveness? And this quote from a practitioner I work with sort of sums up the confusion that practitioners were facing while they were waiting, what should we do about value for money when we evaluate our work? So this practitioner is saying it's very frustrating because DFID's told us, you know, we've got all these pages on value for money, but they don't really know how we should measure it, and we don't know what they're expecting of us. Did you see the call for PPA proposals? There was a narrow definition there. It seems to be much more interested in efficiency than allowing for any broader argument about effectiveness. So we've decided not to dedicate hours to untangling this from PPA evaluation. So when you're going around talking to people, that's a common sentiment. We don't really know what they're talking about, what they want. So what should we do? And a lot of the engagement, the consultancy engagement I've been having is sort of working with organisations trying to, who are about to be reviewed, work out what should we do and how can we show that we're concerned about value for money and that we're delivering it. An interesting presentation I went to at that time with DFID was sort of sharing with the community, with NGOs, sort of showed how this competition and collaboration was playing out. And what they were saying was they just reviewed a round of PPA proposals and found that a lot of the NGOs asking for money were using social return on investment analysis or cost benefit analysis when that wasn't really what they wanted. They wanted it to be linked to programs rather than this sort of isolated econometric sort of analysis. They wanted their partners to show that they were really thinking about how they designed their programs, how they monitored, how they evaluated it. And during the sort of the meeting, it became very clear that a lot of the NGOs had been trying out some of these approaches, social return on investment analysis, which is a very participatory approach to ask how communities value responses that was then monetized. We're finding that their marketing departments were leaping on these single figure numbers, and they were very concerned that that would be communicated to the public as, you know, it's only going to cost £5 to save a person's life, and that was not what their agenda was. They wanted to use value for money to learn. So there were all these conflicting things sort of going on, and I'm a bit worried because I don't know who's in the room, don't want to go into this in detail, but if anybody wants to ask me afterwards, I'm willing to go through it. But since then, a whole set of tools and approaches have been developed to try and speak to value for money, both the sort of management questions and the big evidence questions. And the only thing I really want to sort of emphasise is that they're used at different times in these cycles. Some are very much beforehand, and I think the big weight in DFID is assessing. Sorry, that's too detailed. I'm going to take it off of you. I don't know the audience. Is the big emphasis is really on trying to assess beforehand whether something is going to offer value for money. And although some people are using sort of cost effectiveness analysis or cost benefit analysis, a lot of it is much more about, have people spoken to the people that they're going to work with? Is the theory of change underpinning their development approach? Does it look as if it's going to work? Do it look as if they're going to manage it properly? It's much more a scoring way for the donor to make up their mind, is this going to deliver value for money? And those are the sort of common approaches that are emerging, a much more subjective saying, given our set of values, how should we manage and how should we make sure that the we're pretty much assured of the best value for money will be realised.
What we're finding is these approaches are starting to be used by different ages, is that they're having very different effects on different types of people. So a lot of the NGOs in the UK are saying, we're really glad that it's taking up value for money, it's helping us have conversations about how we allocate our resources that are long overdue, we've neglected it in the past, this is really good, and we're using it for those organisations that are doing very standard programmes. They can start to look at the relative cost effectiveness across their portfolio if they're doing a lot of vaccination programs or direct delivery, for example, the HIV/AIDS Alliance. And they were able to start to look and use value for money to say, okay, there's a big variation in countries of the costs and the effects. Why is this happening? Let's explore what that means. And those that are using social return on investment are understanding their community's understanding of what value is. For people that are finding it a bit disempowering is where the focus is very much on economy and efficiency and what the unit costs of the cost per beneficiary reached. And obviously, I don't know how familiar you are with those sort of metrics, but they often tend to be very simple. Organisations just count the number of people they think they might be reaching and divide it by the budget. And obviously that's not a very meaningful measure of, you know, how much does it cost to have a change in people's lives. So those that are experiencing and feeling that they're very pushed to do that are not very empowered, and it's starting to affect relationships maybe between donors and recipients and between head office and countries, country programmes. So a lot of them being forced to demonstrate they've been saving money to report to DFID, and I've spoken to sort of several NGO practitioners who said, hey, they're pushing us down so low on the budget, how can they then ask us to save on top of that? Some people are finding those that are working on programmes that are about empowerment or changing governance are finding that a lot of the economic metrics, which tend to be on very tangible changes, don't suit their programmes, they're too narrow. And then on the other hand, the results-based programmes, which tend to be assume that you can plan it at the beginning and determine and anticipate what the results will be, are not very effective either, because in many cases it's only once you get into a programme, say if you're working in a very difficult context, where you began to understand the context, you might have to change what you're doing. You can't necessarily stay with a linear plan. So they're finding that if they adjust their value for money is assessed on did they do what they said they would do, that's not very effective, because often when they learn and they talk to communities more and find out what they want, they actually need to change their approaches in order to deliver value for money. There are other concerns that the actual cost of assessing are very high. But for some people who understand the politics, they just say, OK, we understand the government needs us to do some of this, to produce value for money metrics, so let's not get too worried, let's just do it and try and make it work. So the people are experiencing very different things. That was a cartoon of a disappearing effect, a Dilbert cartoon, when he's asked by his boss how much something costs, and he says, I haven't got a clue, I haven't talked to the people I'm working with yet. Is saying, don't worry, I will never hold you to it, just give me a number. And once he's forced to give a number, he's told it's too high. So then he said, well, if you've already decided that, why are you asking me for the input? Is it meant to make you feel that bad? And I've talked to some aid practitioners who very much sort of say, we're feeling the same thing. You know, when we go and we ask for something, we've been pushed so much by our procurement office, we feel really disempowered. And then what's the point? So when we looked at what's sort of influencing what happens, we found that the different value for money approaches and tools, there's nothing inherently good or bad or disempowering about them. It really depends on how they work. And we can't understand what happens just in terms of DFID's asking NGOs or programmes to do it and they're just responding. It's much more complex. People are negotiating, saying, what can we do? We're not sure, we're confused. And what actually is happening in practice very much depends on the nature of the funding relationships, the particular organisational politics and dynamics, competitive tendencies within organisations and how much capacity they have. So the NGOs in the UK, the big NGOs like Oxfam, etc., who have got really good systems, have been quite ready and able to take on and integrate value for money, whereas some of the very small organisations that really struggle to evaluate their work are really finding it very, very difficult. So they're not so empowered. Then individuals. Some individuals have just said, we're not doing it. We are not the sort of organisations that go around squeezing our partners for, you know, economy, etc. So we're going to do it our way. And also programme attributes and context. Obviously, the service delivery programmes are finding it quite easy, whereas programmes working on governance are finding it much more difficult. So what are people doing to kind of respond? Well, one of the most interesting examples, I think, is Christian Aid, who came out very proactively and said, right, we're going to make value for money work for us, and we're going to define it in ways that fit our values. So value for money is about achieving the best results we can with the money and the resources we have, and we're worried about not only the number of people that benefit, but the intensity and sustainability of change and the inclusion. So if we spend more because we're trying to reach poor and marginalised people, that's appropriate because that's what our values tell us about. So they're very much weighted, saying we're worried about equity, effectiveness and sustainability, we're not so worried about low cost. And I think the good thing about this is they then go on to say the way that we're going to apply value for money when we're trying to assess and measure it is going to be in ways that are consistent with our values. So a lot of the work I've been doing with organisations is taking them through a process whereby they define what does value by money mean for us as an organisation, given our potential, our particular values, and then how do we actually apply it. You know, for example, if we say that being participatory, we're very keen on being accountable to the communities we work with, then they must be involved in actually establishing the units of value and in valuing the services that we give them. So I think there's a lot of interest in organisations developing value for money strategies that very much define what value for money means within their particular values, and then their approach to assessing, demonstrating, managing is very much in fitting and in line with that. Some people have just saying no, it's too difficult, some constructive resistance. Some donors are saying we can't start measuring value for money in complex programs. Some of our partners have too little capacity, it's not fair to ask them. So we're going to really just focus on getting better at evaluating outcomes of our work, which the development sector hasn't been terribly good at doing. We don't like to just talk about efficiency metrics like the number of people that attended a meeting costing so much, or the number of people being reached by a programme costing a certain amount of money. We'll only talk about costs in relation to effectiveness and sustainability. And also, I think one of the concerns is that as people start to produce value for money metrics, they're often circulated without notes about the assumptions, the methodologies that have been used to generate them, and then they can be used inappropriately, and that's sort of an increasing concern. And then one of the sort of the more innovative strategies is this really big interest in the use of complexity science thinking, which is very big in the UK and DFID. And it's really trying to address what do we do about programmes that are very difficult to measure, where you can't really use this classic results-based management. And they draw on the work of Ben Ramalingam, who developed a simple sort of framework to look at which of the programmes you can apply random control trials, results-based management, value for money analysis too. And they tend to be quite simple programs that standard implemented in stable contexts. And he argues that programs that are in much more dynamic, difficult political contexts and trying to do political advocacy are much more difficult because they're constantly having to change with the dynamics of what's going on about them. So they need a much more adaptive management approach where you try something, you find out whether it works, and if it's not working, you stop it. If it does work, you try it and do something differently. And this requires a much more sort of nimble, agile way to evaluation and assessing value for money. And at the moment, DFID are very interested, and they've identified what they're calling hard-to-measure results areas, and they're accepting that maybe there's only some of their portfolio that they can apply to a standard results-based management or cost-effectiveness metrics to, and that the others are going to have to be much more creative. So there's a lot of investment of time and effort in saying, okay, how can we find new ways to deal with programmes that aren't predictable, that need to change as people learn and talk to the people they're working with and learn about what they want them to do? How can we monitor progress and adjust using different evaluation approaches? And I think what's interesting, again, is people that have felt quite isolated, who've been struggling with value for money on their own, saying how on earth those people that are operating in fragile states, who are doing governance programmes, if they've been on their own saying how do we respond, there's now much more interest in how do we work together and collaborate. That's both people within DFID, people within NGOs, people in bilateral programmes. How do we all work together with this huge challenge of finding effective ways to assess value for money? I think Rassmann might be giving an example of an approach in these kinds of programmes. So just drawing together some conclusions. I think value for money, although it's a normative idea everybody buys into, It is a political agenda and it's very confusing. It's a very ambiguous thing. It means different things to different people, and approaches used to measure it sort of need to be appropriate. The tools and approaches have very different effects depending on the nature of organisations, etc., to which they're being implemented. So power-aware practitioners who are interested in making sure that some of these approaches don't undermine locally led transformative development really need to understand their own role in how they use these tools and what the possible effects are before they decide what's an appropriate way to engage. And I think there is a tremendous role for organisations and programmes to develop their own value for money strategies and frameworks that clearly mark out, given their particular programmes, what value for money means to them. And then I think there are some key questions in our agenda, because there's a lot of work going on in value for money, but is it really making a difference? Is it making anything more effective? Or is it just about demonstrating to government that we take this seriously? Is it performance? And if it is performance, you know, is it best to just do it and get on with it? Or should those of us that feel it might undermine the process resist furiously? Or is that actually not a good thing to do? And I'm not convinced. I don't really know the answer to that. I'd welcome your thoughts on that. And then I think this is kind of complexity science thinking what helps, and some of this new thinking actually helped us with bridge gaps between difficult measurement approaches which can't be applied to complex programs with very difficult to observe or measure outcomes. And if that doesn't work, what else? What are the other opportunities? If we are serious about demonstrating and trying to assess value for money, what other approaches or theories might assist us with this challenge? Well, that's me, I'm sorry.
Excellent. Sorry about the bit of static we've got here. I don't know if there's anything we can do about that. But turn off the mute. That was all my fault. Russell, are you there?
I'm here.
Fantastic. Great. Were you able to hear that?
No, I didn't. I was on mute. Perhaps that's a good thing.
Although Kathy's
presentation sounded like it was going to be very, very interesting, so I'll have to catch the recording of it sometime.
Okay, that's totally my fault. I thought we were muting you, whereas we were muting ourselves. Right. Okay, well, sorry about that. That was my mistake. But you're on. So.
Okay. Thanks for the opportunity to speak, and I guess... we're really giving a very nuanced view of value for money from the point of view of the managing contractor, and that managing contractor being GRM International. So obviously everyone will have a different opinion, and I'm probably by no means representing all managing contractors, but hopefully some of the stuff that I can share today will help us understanding value for money a little bit more. So I guess with that, we can probably get started. I'll probably go through a little bit quicker because this is the first radio version of a presentation I've ever given. So bear with me. So if we move on to our first slide, I mean, I'm going to start off by saying that for us, value for money is really about outcome and results. It's the starting point, really, of defining what value for money is. And so it requires a very plausible causal relationship between money that is being spent and the outcomes that are being achieved. So for us, it required a whole sort of rethink of the types of financial structures that we have in place in financial systems in terms of our reporting of finances, but also our reporting of outcomes. And we'll move through this, we'll say this in a few different ways through the presentation. But the most important thing is to sort of to try and retain the focus on outcomes and results rather than boiling it down to a purely cost-focused scenario, which is on the next slide, we're talking about what value for money isn't. And it certainly isn't focusing on cost only. It's definitely not choosing the cheapest option. It certainly isn't the easiest thing to measure. And spending less than the total budget can sometimes actually go against the principles of value for money. So this is a challenge that we've had as managing contractors. There's a lot of people, and even people within our own organization, think that value for money is these four things. And so that's a bit of a challenge moving forward. So I guess starting with, Kathy had opened mentioning the National Audit Office of the UK's 3E definition of value for money, so that linear model. So if you look at the next slide, what does that tell us? Well, value for money is the optimal use of resources to achieve intended outcomes. That sounds pretty great, but in practice, representing that is quite difficult. I guess we all understand what the three E's are, I'm assuming. So if we look at sort of the economy, efficiency, and effectiveness, we find that if we're using the argument of causality as a threat for value for money, then it's easier to prove causality at the beginning of that linear relationship and not at the end. So what we find is as you move towards more unknown factors, moving from outputs to outcomes and ultimately to impact, there are feedback loops and there's also unknown influences that impact on those hugely. So our ability to actually report on value for money needs to be cognizant of the fact that the underlying theory of change may not always be correct when we started, but also, more importantly, that as things change, so does our approach to achieving outcomes and ultimately impact needs to change. So I tried to kind of represent this by doing some animation on the slideshow. So if you hit the forward key, you should see a couple of red arrows coming up, showing the feedback between outputs and outcomes. And then if you hit the forward key again, a similar thing with impact, but this time impact, once we start achieving our impacts, then there's a feedback for how the outcomes and the causality between the outcomes and the impact work, but also how outputs and impact work. The point I'm trying to make here, I guess, is if you hit the forward key again, is it's those other influences that often are downplayed when you look at their impact on our ability to achieve results. So it's all very well and good having a theory of change and identifying risks, but you also need to be able to be responsive to how those unknown influences might impact on the ability to work. If we move on to the next slide, so I'm saying the same thing again, we believe that achieving value for money requires that we have the establishment of a strong value proposition at the beginning. And this means understanding all the assumptions around what we assumed the theory of change would be. So you're moving outside of the, trying to understand the nonlinear aspects of that relationship. And then continuously reappraising the situation both internally and externally to see whether or not things have changed. And if things have changed, what's the best approach to actually still deliver as best we can the outcomes and ultimately the impact that's intended. So this needs, it really needs a strong understanding of the theory of change, and not just the theory of change around the particular program that we're looking at, but also around the implications for the different assumptions in that theory of change. If those move or become non-relevant, then what can we do about that? And to do that, we really need to have a functional and, I guess, comprehensive monitoring and evaluation system, which is great, but we also need to be careful about creating too much data, because we really need to be creating data that we can actually use to make changes. And if we're going to have data that we're going to use to make changes, then there needs to be some flexibility in the program implementation. And from our very nuanced view, we find that often there isn't a lot of flexibility in program implementation. Once a theory of change is defined in the beginning of the contract relationship, we find that it's fairly fixed and rigid, and it's very difficult to prove that a trajectory forward is not going to work, especially in the absence of real-world evidence in that space. So, if we move on to the next slide, something that came out of the ACFID paper, which we found very useful, is to say that, you know, improving value for money is really a combination of three different things, and depending on the situation, it's weighted differently. So to improve value for money, we need to be able to manage value for money using the right process. So that means we need to, right in the beginning, establish the right mechanisms, the right M&E framework, the right sort of, let's say, procurement systems, etc., to make sure that we're achieving the best cost for inputs. We also need to be able to compare these against other programs. Probably use a bit of caution here to say that, you know, it's got to be comparison of like for like. So to compare the rates that you're paying for technical advisors in Kabul, Afghanistan, you need to compare those to another fairly sort of risky sort of environment, rather than say, you know, the price of technical assistance in Australia. So you have to make sure that you're comparing like to like. And then also be able to demonstrate value for money through the evaluation of program outputs. And what that means is really being able to take the program outputs and being able to assign a cost to those. So we know how much we spend on a program, but there also are other people that are investing in program outcomes. So how do you actually measure what's been invested in achieving a certain outcome? So if we hit the arrow key, ultimately for us, value for money has to be a mindset. It can't just be a bolt-on or an added-on thing. It's something that we all need to do every day as managing contractors, but also as donors, also as service providers, and certainly as beneficiaries as well, or recipients of aid funding. We need to ask if we're getting the most out of the resources that we have. If we aren't, then what can we do to get more out of those resources? Are we doing things in the right way? And are we doing the right things? And will this achieve the greatest impact? And if so, what's the cost of that? And can we look around us to see if other people are working in the same space and doing stuff where we could either be a leader to them or they could be a leader to us? So this idea of shared learning around best practice. And then are we able to demonstrate what we achieve, and even more importantly, what we can achieve? So a lot of our work happens before there's any achievement, especially in the initial phases of a program. So how do we actually show that the theory of change that we had assumed in the beginning is still valid and still going to achieve results? It's very easy to talk through these things, but they obviously are very, very difficult things to measure and to report on, and also to get agreement on at sort of the highest level. So I guess sort of one of the examples that I wanted to use around how we actually report on value for money is to look at a very recent DFID procurement notice that happened to be on my desk when I was putting this presentation together. So if you go to the next slide, the procurement notice speaks a lot about value for money, but then to prove that you have considered value for money, you need to show a value for money plan that includes specific year-on-year efficiency targets which demonstrate continual cost savings and systems improvement. So that sounds all right, but it kind of relates to a few common metrics that we have been reporting on through some of our other programs, which are things like the average daily fee rate for international and national staff, the number of national and international staff, the number of reports produced and the cost of each, and so on. So it touches on, in terms of the three E's, it touches on the E of economy and it touches on the E of efficiency a little bit, but it doesn't really move to the idea of effectiveness. And I guess this is what we started the whole forum off with, was saying, you know, the issue of aid effectiveness and how we measure it is an age-old thing, and it still rears its head in value for money reporting. So we find as managing contractors is really very difficult to be able to actually report on value for money, because we're often sort of reduced down to reporting on cost elements only. And the other side of that is that actually reporting on those things sometimes requires a whole setup of other systems that then come at a cost but don't really generate sufficient value. So by being able to track infinitesimally small costs and then try and improve those, we don't get much value out of that, but we've had to set up whole systems to actually do that and employ people to monitor those things. So what we think real value for money reporting implies, if we move on to the next slide, is that there's a strong culture of data collection and use, and this is obviously from the managing contractor's point of view, or the service provider, but the previous slide implied that there needs to be a strong data collection, but didn't really speak to how we could use it so well. So we need to be able to generate relevant data and then also be able to use it to improve. And to do this, we need to have very strong project systems, which include the right resource allocation and staffing. And that's when I say the right resource allocation and staffing, I mean the right resources and staff at the right price. So we have to be very clear about the type of quality output that we want to produce and how much it's going to cost to produce that. And then, of course, look for efficiencies as we move through the process of seeing if we can improve as we go through. We also need to have a very clear progress assessment framework and be able to evaluate that against what the program's hoping to achieve, and then be able to take corrective action where needed. So there's an element of transparency, but there's also an element of research, I guess, in that. And we need to be able to effectively react to changes in either the donor or the recipient needs. Obviously, the donor is the funder. We need to be responsive to whatever their strategic priorities might be. But equally important, the recipient's needs need to be sensitive, or the program needs to be sensitive to their needs in the first place. And to get maximum value for money, you need your recipients to buy in. We also need, as we said earlier, a very deep institutional knowledge and understanding. So we have a wonderful theory of change for most projects or programs, but if that changes, we really need to understand how we can use that situation to best sort of still garner the outcomes and impacts we're hoping to achieve. We place a strong emphasis on accountability for results delivery, and that's accountability by ourselves as managing contractors, donors as well as providers of funding, and also to the recipients that are receiving the funding. So it implies that all three of those parties need to really understand what we want to achieve and to be accountable for actually achieving those results. The reporting on cost really comes in from the managing contractor side, but then there are other aspects in terms of, you know, supporting those processes that the donors can do and that the recipients would buy into. We also need to, for value for money, we really need to be aware of the environments that we're working in, and we need to look for complementarities in implementation. That can be within or between sectors, also within or between geographies, and looking across the different donors to see who's doing what and who might be doing things better. So it's this theme of constant improvement all the time. Most importantly for us is something that sometimes gets forgotten, is the sustainability and capacity building element of the work that we do. So capacity building and sustainability tend to actually cost money when you want to build the capacity of, say, a local staff unit. It's going to cost you, you're going to have to invest in that. But the benefit is that you have an enduring impact. The impact lasts longer than the program does, which is what we should really be aiming to achieve. So with that in mind, we've really sort of had a very big think about this. We've probably spent the last couple of years thinking about value for money from the GRM perspective, recognizing that we work across multiple sectors, geographies, and donors. So trying to look at how we can best sort of position our value for money response in a way that actually delivers value for money, which sounds great, but it's not been so easy in practice. I thought one of the ways I would show how we are doing it is to actually give you a real example from a program that's just come out of the design phase in Nigeria. It's a governance program, and it's for DFID, so we've had to use the 3E approach in terms of reporting on value for money. And if you go on to the next slide, you can see it's broken down there into economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. Pretty much the economy focuses on the systems and processes that we use to actually get best cost and value. We're aiming to have a high value to cost ratio in technical advisor inputs, and that's because we want to be using our technical advisors in this program strategically, and so because they're more expensive, hopefully reduce the cost by only using them strategically. And then there's also some specific monetary costs and savings. So because we have other programs in the same geography, we can do some cost sharing, some resource sharing as well. And those are identified in the value for money framework. In terms of efficiency, we actually look at how we can assign costs to output and even to sub-outputs. And we've had to restructure our financial accounting system to do that. But nonetheless, sort of we have the structure that now we can report on an input basis, but we can also report on an output basis. And that's very, very important, as you'll see in a second. We also are looking at the types of indicators that we can use to measure how we're actually garnering the in-kind contributions that partners are making, so non-cash contributions perhaps, and how that multiplies our efficiency in delivering on outputs and then the knock-on onto outcomes and impacts. And also looking at one of the approaches that the program's embarking on is to actually become excellent in one state first and then move over to another state using the learning that was done from the state before, rather than a national broad-based approach to that. So there's some indicators around the transfer of knowledge and learning and the efficiency of the process as you move from one state to another. Also effectiveness, so that really looks more at the M&E side of things, so collecting results and trying to attribute change to the different activities within the program. Then moving to measuring improvements in key governance processes, which is the objective of this program. And then trying to find tangible results, which is sort of quantifying the value of change where possible through a developed series of case studies, change stories, and then attribution to the different actors involved, not just the program itself, but then balancing this against the costs of program delivery. So if we head forward, you'll see some of the indicative indicators that we've put against those things, and probably to say that, for example, in the economy one, we have about 25 different indicators that we're looking at over this five-year program. For the efficiency one, we probably have around 15 or so, and effectiveness, I think there's 8 altogether. And the effectiveness ones look at effectiveness in relation to outcomes and also to impact. But those ones will only be measurable as we move through the program, so over time. What they're really aiming to do is to allow us to actually get to a reporting goal, if we head forward again, which gives us the dollar cost of providing access so that one individual can claim rights and hold government to account, which sounds quite grandiose, and the economist in me thinks that it's brilliant, but really it does raise a couple of issues, and that's in terms of reducing all of our work down to a dollar value to show the value doesn't necessarily work. But also, in reality, to actually come up with a dollar cost attributed to a single outcome is not the easiest thing to do, and we still haven't done it yet. So I guess what we're trying to say is that this is a good endpoint to have in terms of the program I was talking about, the governance program in Nigeria. We certainly have all the indicators for economy, efficiency, and effectiveness, but we still need to work on how we achieve our reporting goal, if that is the goal for value for money. So I guess, and I have moved through this really quickly without having been able to take questions through the presentation. If we go on to the last slide, I guess just a summary of what we see as key features of programs that deliver value for money. As what I've said in the beginning and in the middle, we need to have costs that are linked to clear outcomes. So we need to really define our cost reporting structure and also our M&E structure so we can link costs to outcomes. And we need to decide how quickly and when we need to measure those. Collecting all the information at the end of a program does nothing for improving the program because you won't really have a chance to use the data to make improvements. So we really need to bring that in as early as possible. We need to make sure that we have systems in place and that the project design actually ensures the effective delivery of outcome and strong risk mitigation. So that implies that there's flexibility in the approach, because without that, you really are sort of stuck on the trajectory that you're sort of initially committed to. And then we say it's really important, of course, to have a project design that prioritizes sustainability and capacity building. So that once we move out as managing contractors, once we pull away or the donor withdraws funding for a particular program, the work of the program can still continue if the capacity has been built. And that's going to have huge value for money implications. And then really finally is a project design that looks outwards. And I guess this is where we've been approaching value for money from, is to say, well, can we look at where there are complementarities with the other work that we're doing? So it means we need to be looking at how we deliver our work the same space for different projects or programs. And that's something that we're working on at the moment. As I say, it's sort of very, very big work in progress, but we are making some headways with trying to standardize some of the ways we look at this, but then also understanding that there's never going to be a cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all type of value-for-money framework that we can apply to all our work. So that's just a very quick sort of overview of what we're doing in the value-for-money space. And, of course, I realize I've been going through it really quickly, but that's pretty much all I wanted to say on it.
Well, Russell, thank you. I just want to congratulate you on your delivery. That couldn't have been easy. It was very clear we could all hear you. There are about 100 people here all hanging on to every word.
Lovely.
And, you know, especially since you hadn't heard any of the presentation before, which was my fault. Well done. I might just make a couple of comments myself, if you don't mind, very briefly. I think it's been a very balanced discussion. We've heard pros and cons of this issue. But just to end on two positive notes, it seems to be in Australia, you know, that statement that Mitchell made, if we had a minister in Australia say that he actually wanted value for money from aid, and then he or she was taken seriously, that would be a big step forward. So that does show a kind of political seriousness about aid that is perhaps missing in Australia. And it'll be interesting to see whether that is remedied after the election. And the other thing I'd say, it seems, you know, a lot of their focus is on economy and efficiency, and to some extent that might be a limitation. On the other hand, if we think of all the pressures in aid in the other direction, in particular the pressure to spend, right? We have this budget, we have to spend it. That, of course, mitigates against, because the more economical and efficient you are, the harder it is to spend the budget. So perhaps this is a correction from an earlier bias in the other direction. Anyway, just two of my thoughts. I want to thank both of our speakers, Kathy coming all the way from the UK, and Russell for the fantastic job you've done over the phone. But that's it for tonight. Very interesting discussion. Thanks everyone for coming, and thanks to our speakers.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.